The first ever professional baseball league serving the Middle East and South Asia, bringing America's pastime to 2 billion new fans. Let's go. John Medrick, what's going on, my friend? I appreciate you doing this.
Michael, my brother, really appreciate the opportunity to just talk a little bit about our mission here in Baseball United to bring the great game of baseball to 2 billion people on the other side of the world. Humble and hungry, my brother.
From Lieutenant and Commanding Officer of the NYPD International Liaison Unit to the Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations for Baseball United, both titles are eye-opening, beyond impressive. Are you ready to fill in the gaps between those two awesome jobs?
I hope I can.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island, New York, born in 79. So, I'm lucky enough to be a 70s kid by a few months. Grew up just over the border, about 5 miles east of the city border of Queens.
Always wanted to be a cop, or was there another career path you wanted to take?
No, quite frankly, from the time I became a serious human being, all I wanted to do was become a cop. School was something early on that I didn't really excel in. It's something I really didn't understand the value in. Quite frankly, I didn't do as well as I should have. When I kind of screwed my head on straight, in the early years of community college, probably late high school even, was when I really realized that, I wanted to be a cop. And I think that when you're from where we're from, Mike, if you want to be a cop, there's only one place to be a cop, in my opinion, and that's the NYPD. It's the only test I took. I didn't take Suffolk. I didn't take Nassau. I didn't take the state troopers. When you want to be a cop, I think the only place to be a cop is with the NYPD.
And then you graduate the academy, a dude from Long Island, and now you get assigned to the 75, East New York, Cypress Hills. That's some culture change. So you really jumped right into being a cop.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when I graduated the academy, I asked to go to the 75 Priest, and I figured that it was the best place to learn, to really learn how to be a cop. A tremendously eye-opening opportunity, and it's something that I wouldn't, trade in for the world. I think that, as a police officer, as you're well aware of, I believe that your best asset or your best tool is the skill of communication. And, being, out there on the streets of East New York, I just think that, as a young cop, I learned how to talk to people, how to respect people. And really, that skill of communication started there. I wasn't cognizant of the fact that I was building this communication skill. But, that's really, in hindsight, looking back at really what I was doing. So it was an unbelievable experience and opportunity. That I wouldn't trade in for anything in the world.
Your family and friends think a young John Medrick is saving the world. They watch TV shows kicking in the doors. Maybe it was a silly arrest. Maybe it was a horrible night in the snow, wherever you were in the 75. Give me a night early on in your career that you're thinking to yourself, what did I sign up for? What am I doing here?
Oh, I'll give you a great night. I wasn't long out of the academy, and there was an inspector at the time. He wound up retiring as a three-star chief, James Secreto, but he was the commander of the precinct at the time. And, so I'm a young cop. I'm 22 years old, and it's towards the end of my tour. We're an FTU, right? The field training unit. So we're working I think it's a 10 in the morning to 18, 35 hours to 6:35 p.m. And I my sister was graduating. My younger sister was graduating from eighth grade. And, it was a great learning lesson for me, I'll tell you that much. But anyway, so I come into the precinct that, I don't know, it's probably 6 o'clock at night. I had 35 minutes left for my tour. I had to do a few administrative things. So I go stand before the desk, and I can't tell you why I was doing this, but I just thought, I guess I was cooler than I was, but my tie wasn't clipped on right. As all of us, hair bags, my tie clipped on to the one side of the open, my open collar. And as I'm standing in front of the desk, the sergeant was like a salty guy with, 4 or 5 stripes, hash marks on his arm. And at that point, then Inspector Secreto comes up to the desk to get the gas card, still when you needed, the gas card from the desk to fill up his car. And I was asking him to go admin. And Inspector Secreto sees me, does a double take, He takes the gas card, walks out, turns around and goes, "And rookie, put your tie on correctly." So I clip my tie on. And at that point, the desk sergeant goes, "When do you get off, kid?" I go, "I get off in 35 minutes. I told you it was the night of my sister's graduation. He goes, "Okay, great. I want you to go out in Van Sickelen and New Lots and stand on a foot post there for the last 35 minutes of your tour." Anyone would know it would take me 35 minutes to walk there. So unbelievable learning experience. And really, I think that that's one of my first experiences, I guess, actually on patrol and in uniform. And it was such a great lesson learned that night about just, you know, doing the right thing. The way you do one thing is the way you do everything. So professionalism was important. And I think that, you know, when it happened under my breath on the way at the post, I probably had a few choice words for both the sergeant and the commander at the time. But, you know, it was a great lesson learned for me. I know that was a long-winded answer, but it's something that stuck out and really, you know, it really stuck out to me how important it was to live and die by the rules and regulations of the organization and doing things the way that they should be done.
And the uniform, the tie, when you're put together, you know, you and I have watched a million videos when they interview cop killers, they say, "What made you do it?" And a lot of times they're like, "I didn't think of it when I saw him. He wasn't squared away. He wasn't sharp. I didn't think." So those little things that we don't think of, there's a reason they've been in place for the last 300 years in the history of policing.
No, it's exactly right. And you're talking about the human psyche, which is a very deep thing. And you're 100% right. You got to look, you know, so when I bring that thing, whenever we bring it full circle, you know, one of the things that, you know, I talk about now oftentimes to my son, who's a young developing baseball player or players that, you know, are coming to play in the Baseball United League. You know, one of the things is that I always talk to them about is you have to look the part to be the part. And you know, you got to dress for the job you want, not necessarily for the one you have. And it all fits into that lesson, I guess, that I was taught by that desk sergeant of that day.
You get promoted. You go to Queens, Jackson Heights, East Elmhurst. Then you get scooped up by Internal Affairs. Did you enjoy the supervisory rank? And how did that supervisory rank help you now with your new positions?
Mike, listen, really becoming a supervisor in the NYPD honestly changed my life in a way I can't even explain. You know, again, I was a kid who all I ever wanted to do was become a city cop. As I told you, I come on the job. I'm in East New York. I was in anti-crime, you know, high violence suppression unit, gun suppression unit, wearing plain clothes, driving around in unmarked cars. So I was at like the pinnacle. I was young. I was 26 years old, I guess. At this, you know, I got into the unit early on in my career and I was already there for a couple of years. I'm 26 years old and, you know, single, enjoying life. You know, I didn't think I had no ambition or had no idea that, you know, what the next step for me was. Somebody challenged me to take the sergeant's test, said to me, "Hey, I bet you that I can get a higher score than you." And I said, "What? Yeah, I don't think you can." And I'm a very headstrong guy, as you've probably come to know, Mike. And, you know, when somebody put that challenge to me, I said to myself, there's absolutely no way. So what I did was I studied harder than I ever studied for ever anything in my life. Remember going back to what I first said, I wasn't a great student, but I started hitting the books real hard. And really my number one priority was to pass that super sergeant's test. And they hadn't given a test in a couple of years, in like 2 or 3 years at this point, just because of promotions and things like that and the way that it was going. So I take the test. I think there was about 6,000 people taking it that one Saturday in 2005, I guess that was. Yeah, 2005. And I wound up finishing, well, my list number was number two, right? So I get promoted right away. I'm 27 years old. I'm literally the youngest sergeant on the NYPD at this point because I hit my 5 years and you know, I was really the youngest guy on the department that time for a short time as a sergeant. Get deployed to, I get, you know, promoted and they send me to the 115. I actually, again, asked to go there. Such a diverse community. If you look at Jackson Heights, Queens, there's more people from different areas of the world in Jackson Heights than, you know, really anywhere in the world with over 220 different ethnicities represented there. So just a great opportunity to go. Unbelievable opportunity to be a supervisor. My first job there, I was a supervisor on the 4 to 12s, just in charge of you know, the day-to-day police operations within the command. I remember like being a, I think it was my first year. Yeah, it was. I was only a sergeant a couple of months and or maybe a month. And I was on the 4 to 12, the, you know, it was Thanksgiving Day. I'm the desk sergeant who, as you know, the desk sergeant, if you studied for a test, is in charge of all police operations in the command. So the platoon commander winds up calling in sick and there's another sergeant down the street. So I'm thinking to myself, I'm 27 years old. I'm a sergeant a month and I'm in charge of this, you know, vast, highly densely populated place of Jackson Heights. I made it through the night. Thank God. Had great cops working for me. In a short time, I get the opportunity to, because of my expertise and a couple of things that I did to really impress at the time, the deputy inspector was the commander. They made me the field training supervisor for some time there. It was the first time so there was like an impact class, which was really, really cool. I really got to, that job I love because you got to influence young kids and what they, you know, who they became on this department. And a few of those kids went on to become supervising detectives. And really, I think that I played a role, an important role, with shaping them in the right way. Then I was an anti-crime supervisor. And then, as you said, get grabbed by IAB. So great, great time as a supervisor. Again, another long-winded answer, but I think that was important to give some context there.
No, it is. And just so you know, I do a million of these podcasts. The worst thing in the world is when you ask a question and they give you the quick answer right away. It's like, all right, I want, you know, you want to get to learn the guest, but another test, another promotion, I think it was around 2010, and you get transferred to Intel. You don't get assigned to East New York or East Elmhurst. You go to the Middle East. Explain how this international liaison unit gig came about and you going abroad. John Meijer from Long Island going abroad. How'd this happen?
So actually, yes, so you're 100% right. Well, you're 99% right. I was actually still a sergeant when I got brought into Intel. So okay. I go to Intel in, I was in internal affairs, as you know, and I, you know, was looking for where to, when I got assigned to, you know, internal affairs, most people or a lot of people think that's like a death sentence, right? And what I said to myself was, I'm going to really use this as an opportunity to learn, right? To learn the job from another perspective, to learn the skill of investigations and as a supervisor, managing and supervising investigations. I also just started to do a deep dive in studying on radical Islamic terror. And, you know, as I did that for my 2 years, I was in internal affairs just about 2 years. As I started to doing that, it came across my desk somewhere. I read that the NYPD had this overseas liaison unit in which it was, you know, a unit that was built after 9/11. Obviously, 9/11 taught NYPD that terrorism has a global reach. And in response to that, NYPD understood that we need to have a global reach to prevent global terrorism, right? So it was news to me that we had NYPD detectives and sergeants deployed around the world. So actually, there was a news article. I forget what newspaper it was. It was one of the New York newspapers had an article in which they talked about the NYPD's international liaison program, and they interviewed then Commissioner Raymond Kelly. And the exact heading or the title of the article was not strong. You know how they call the police the strong arm of the law. The name of the article was the long arm of the law, and there was a picture of the globe with NYPD logos. Representing different cities in which the liaisons were located. And so I read this and I kind of said, oh my God, this is unbelievable. This can't be true. I cut out the article and I hung it right on the wall next to my desk. And I would read it every single day at work in internal affairs. And a lot of the people said to me, well, what are you looking at that for? Like, that's such an elite unit. You're in internal affairs. Nobody can, I mean, that's like the elite of the elite of the elite. And to be honest with you, as I told you already, a challenge was already made in my mind. So I said, no, I'm going to this unit. Next thing you know, I do a few interviews to go to this unit with then commission. Well, a couple of people, Chief Tom Galati, who is now still the chief of counterterrorism and intelligence, who was one of my mentor on this job. Then David Cohen, who was the ex-deputy commissioner of counterterrorism for the NYPD. So I went to probably half a dozen to 10 interviews for this job to get into Intel to one of the overseas position. My wife is from the Dominican Republic. I have some property down there. I speak fluent Spanish. So my wish was to go down to the Dominican Republic. So I do all these, I do these interviews, and I guess I do a good job on them. And I get a call that says, okay, we're interested in offering you a position. So I tell my wife, I think I'm going to the DR. I show up at Police Plaza, room 1108, which you know what room that is. And they said, hey, you did great on the interviews. We want to offer you a spot. And I said, great. Where am I going to go in intelligence? They said, how's the Amman Jordan sound? So it was a little bit different than what I was thinking. However, what I can say is it was an unbelievable opportunity at an unbelievable time in an unbelievable place to do the type of work that we were there doing. So again, divinely, divine intervention, I believe.
Day-to-day activities there included what?
Well, our, you know, the NYPD liaison unit, international domestic liaison unit, is a unit under the police department, the intelligence bureau. And the job is basically you're sharing best practices, lessons learned, real-time information and intelligence that allows the NYPD to play a preventative or proactive defense against terror and transnational crime. So my job, you know, was unlike many other of the American law enforcement or diplomatic community that was, you know, on the ground in Amman. You know, I didn't show up at the American embassy every day. That's not where my office was. My job was every single day I reported to Jordanian police, the PSD, the Public Security Directorate's intelligence bureau, and worked with them on a day-to-day basis in order to create, you know, those direct relationships, cop-to-cop relationships, in order to again, play really for the war on terror and transnational crime.
Do you think out there is where you really understood the importance of building connections, cultivating relationships that led you to Baseball United, which we're going to talk about because the relationships you have at Baseball United is out of control? Do you think there in Jordan is where you really solidified your gift of making connections and seeing how important relationships are?
Well, yeah, I would say that that's actually where I probably for the first time realized how significant, you know, these relationships are, because the reality is when there's trust, you know, one of the things that the NYPD does, and I learned from, you know, doing this job as a liaison officer and then later on as the commander of the unit, was, you know, it's so important to have a relationship prior to needing that relationship, right? So we put so much time, effort, and really resources into front loading those relationships to create a strong bond, you know, between us and other organizations, so that if and when we need to call on that organization or those individuals in that organization for the needs of the NYPD, it's not like I'm cold calling you, right? So I understood how important it was. And I think that one of the other things that, you know, a lot of people who aren't in this business really just don't understand. And I actually, when I became the commander of the unit, had to really communicate this to the executive levels of the organization, was that it's a hard work maintaining and building a network, right? It's hard work. It, you know, I know that there's a lot of friendships that are gained out of it. And there's a lot of things that are done outside of the normal business hours mm-hmm. and the normal office that kind of, you know, solidify these relationships, but it is hard work. And you know, hats off to all the guys and gals who worked with me and for me doing that. What I would say is, you said that the NYPD in this position really taught me how important those relationships were. But I can say this, where I learned how to do it wasn't from myself. It was from a lot of the people who worked for me, because they were a lot better at it than I was, quite frankly. I think that when I look around the world and see some of the individuals who I worked with when I was overseas and then who worked under me when I commanded the unit, they really showed me how to do it. I understood the importance when I was in Jordan, but maybe I don't think that I was at the level that a lot of the liaisons for NYPD are, quite frankly. So I would say I learned the importance of it from that position, but I learned how to do it, I think, from the people who worked under me, quite frankly.
And how long were you stationed out there in Jordan?
I was there for 2.5 years. I was there from 2000 and, you know, just to give you a little time, I think this is an important one here. So I get to Amman in two, 2010, in March of 2010, in like the middle of March. And, you know, if you just go back to your history books here, I get there right after the Syrian civil wars, you know, explodes. And Amman, if you just look geographically where it is, you're only about 40 miles south of the Syrian border. So a lot of the Syrian refugees who, you know, unfortunately were just, you know, distraught and had nowhere to go, that had to flee Syria, had made their way into Jordan. Many of them were housed up in northern Jordan in refugee camps. However, thousands upon thousands obviously made their way to Amman because they had family connections, you know, who moved there earlier, or they were intermarried with Jordanian families. So I get there, as I said, in March. The Arab Spring was in full, you know, full effect. Osama bin Laden, they found Osama bin Laden on May 1st. So it was like 6 weeks after I got there. So really, really just an unbelievable time, right? An unbelievable time to be in the Middle East. Just really just learned a lot and then spent, you know, the next 30 months there and came back.
What food did you miss the most while you were out there?
Oh, I guess being a New Yorker and being from Western Nassau County, I'm going to go with pizza, right? You can't find a good slice of pizza. Now, there's obviously much debate amongst us New Yorkers. What is the best slice? You know, some prefer Sicilian, some prefer, you know, just a regular New York slice. So I would say pizza, and it may be from King Umberto's in Elmont.
Wow, you even went specific on me. Now, you're back in New York City, and now you're the commanding officer of one, and you used the word I was going to use, the one not only of the most elite units in the NYPD, but realistically, and maybe the whole world of policing. You're in charge of all these posts all over the world. Did you enjoy the gig? And now you come back. You were there. You were in Jordan. Now you're back. I hate to sound silly, but you're in charge of the whole world now. You have all these posts all over. Did you feel the stress of it at the time?
Well, so I come back and I'm basically, you know, offered the position to command the International Domestic Liaison Program. And it was just such a humbling opportunity for me. I'm not sure at that time I understood the significance of it, to be quite honest with you. Just unbelievable, unbelievable opportunity. You see day to day. I mean, when you're looking at it from a managerial and commanding the organization, obviously I worked directly under the chief of intelligence. But quite frankly, the strategic direction of the organization and the day to day operations were basically under my responsibility. Just such an unbelievable experience. I mean, I now when I think back, I kind of pinch myself just because, I mean, you know, Mike and To start, you know, we talked about being a kid from Long Island and, you know, starting in East New York to getting drafted to, well, going to the 115 in Jackson Heights, and then to go into internal affairs, you know, to be on six continents on behalf of the NYPD and dozens of countries, you know, one has to pinch themselves and say, how did this happen? How did this happen? You know, and really to do some really good work and really, really work that I'm proud of. And I'm proud of the people that I worked with, quite frankly, for what we did, whether it was November 13th, 2015, when the bombs went off in Paris. You know, quite frankly, I mean, I'm not sure there was a better time and place to be than there as the commander of that unit for the time that I was there. Really just, you know, I'm still, as I said, I pinch myself and I'm forever in debt to, you know, Chief Galati and, you know, just for believing in me to give me the opportunity to do this.
There was a job, the time that the International Liaison Unit came on my radar was 2018. I believe you were the boss. There was this famous job in New York, the tragic murder of an 8-month-old baby. Can you tell that story about how the whole thing transpired? Because that's when it came on everyone's radar. There's been cops who were cops for 30 years. Like, we have guys overseas. Tell that story, because that's one of the most fascinating stories I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, it's another great point, Mike. And you know, to give you a little bit of background, and I don't remember every single detail of it, but generally I remember the case and I know exactly what you're speaking of. But to give you a little background, and I think it's important, because you just said, you know, you're an NYPD detective, and like you said, there's guys you know, and gals who spend, you know, a decade or two decades with the organization, they don't even know we have people overseas. Because as I talked about, much of what I was talking about was our, let's say, our counterterrorism intelligence mission. One of the things that happened under the, you know, under my command when I was in charge of the day-to-day ops of the unit, however, through the leadership of the chief intelligence at the time, we really made a business decision, if you will, in order to shift our focus from strictly being like on boots on the ground for counterterrorism, but being full service police liaisons to assist the NYPD and its investigators in a myriad of ways, not just in counterterrorism. So this is one of those cases where it wasn't a terrorism case. You said it was, you know, as you said, it was a homicide of a young baby who was, I believe at the, I think it, the baby was less than a year old.
Yeah, 8 months actually.
Oh, 8 months. There you go. So from my recollection of the story, basically what happens is there's a baby who is found in the East River somewhere right around the base of the Brooklyn Bridge by a family who's visiting, you know, tourists basically to New York City. And the basically the baby, obviously, they call the police. The coroners take, you know, possession of the baby, but obviously an investigation takes place. This has nothing to do with intelligence. It has nothing to do with my unit. It's strictly the traditional detective bureau who you know, investigate, you know, crimes in New York City. And somehow or another, they put two and two together that there's a baby missing from the Bronx, right? And so there was a custody battle or there was, you know, a case in which a mother and a father had some kind of shared custody over this 8-month-old baby. And the father had came to pick up the baby for his weekend stay, at which time I believe that the father murdered the baby up in his apartment in the Bronx and put the baby's body, the corpse, in a backpack and walked it out and dumped it in the river, the baby in the river. So again, not an intelligence bureau case, strictly detective bureau. But what happens was when they identify, and this happened over the weekend, I believe, this case was going on. And what had happened was they identified the father as obviously the lead suspect in the case. So the detectives in the case called the NYPD intelligence bureau's, 24-hour operations unit to kind of put a travel alert on this, you know, the father, because he was the lead suspect in the case. When they do that, they realize the father already beat town and was on a flight. So that's when my unit gets activated, because now we know the father is outside the continent of the United States, or outside of New York City, I should say. And now it's basically, hey, how can you guys help? So it was a really, really unique case. And let me just try to remember exactly what had happened. But so I think what had happened was the father was on a flight to Abu Dhabi, which was a travel hub for the Eastern Hemisphere, in which, you know, it was basically a layover flight. So when we get this information, the way we were able to do that was when the information comes into the ops desk, we go to CBP, Customs and Border Protection. We ask them to do a travel check on this individual. They tell us, yeah, he's on a flight to Abu Dhabi. We wake up our detective in Abu Dhabi. It was the middle of the night there. We say, hey, we need you to find this guy and grab this guy off the flight. He says, okay, yeah, I can try to do that. When he called his contacts, again, the relationships are so important, because he was able to wake people up out of bed and to, you know, do him the favor and to do the NYPD the favor to try to, you know, find this needle in the haystack. They get back to our liaison and say, hey, by the way, he already beat it. He's gone. And we don't necessarily know where he went, because, you know, if he was just coming through as a transit, traveler, we don't log all those travelers in. It was only if he actually left the airport and got into Abu Dhabi. So that didn't happen. We said, well, we really need this guy because of what had happened. He just killed his 8-year-old baby. They said, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go to the next step. We're going to stop pulling flight manifests and try to find what flight left around that time and what flight he got on. So they had located him. They had located him on a flight going into, I believe it was Mumbai, but India for sure, I believe. They said, hey, you know, start working on that. But this is the flight the guy's on. We start calling contacts there. We find out that he already landed in India and he already boarded a flight on his way to Singapore.
Oh, my God.
No, excuse me, Thailand, on his way to Thailand, Bangkok, Thailand. He was landing in Bangkok, Thailand in about 2 hours from then. So he was wheels up from India, about 2 hours out of Bangkok. We wake up our liaison in Singapore, who is a sergeant, who's been out there a good amount of time, but it comes back to what I was talking about, front loading those relationships. We have a great relationship at this point with the Royal Thai Police, because our liaison there would make regular trips, you know, to maintain those relationships and really build out his network. So again, he's now able to press go right away once he gets this call, calls the Royal Thai Police. They wind up saying, yeah, no problem, we'll take care of it. We now make the decision that our liaison is going to be en route to Thailand and land. As he's making the phone calls to the Royal Thai Police, he's on his way to the airport himself to get.
Yeah, this is the Singapore liaison going there.
Exactly. So he's in Singapore. He's on his way to Thailand, lands about 2 hours after the suspect lands. Now, here's where things get, and this will show you the value and the strength of the NYPD's relationships and how important this unit is for really to fight transnational crime. See, if the Royal Thai Police would have stamped this guy's passport and he would have got, you know, and he's free on the streets of Bangkok, by the way, there's more hotels in Bangkok than anywhere in the world. And I'm sure you know, because you're a world.
I'm actually wearing a Bangkok shirt right now.
small world. So if he goes out and hits the streets of Bangkok, good luck trying to find this guy. Now, there's no doubt eventually the U.S. Marshal Service or someone would have found them. But how many months, how many resources would have it took? Then when they get him, now there's a whole extradition process that needs to take place because he's in Bangkok. He's in Thailand. And now you're going to waste, you know, a year of time and taxpayer money to now negotiate the terms of this guy being, you know, really extradited out of Thailand. The catch here was, because we got him before he ever was wheels down and he never crossed the passport threshold, technically the Thai police department or the Thai border authorities never allowed him to come into the country. So he was never in Thailand. Well, he's in the airport standing on let's say, the Thailand's, airport, the turf, but he was never admitted entry into Thailand. So they say, as long as we don't let him pass border control, we'll just keep him off to a room before that person stamps his passport, which exactly is what they did. They put him in this room and they said, stay here. The next thing that he heard was this, and this is a true story. The next thing he heard was, because remember, I told you the Singapore liaison was landed in about an hour and a half, 2 hours after he did. And the sergeant, I won't say the sergeant's name, but he went into the room. He says, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I'm Sergeant So-and-so from the NYPD. We're here to talk to you about, and the guy just looks at him and goes, holy shit, how did you get here this quick? So what had happened at that point was we took our liaison from Abu Dhabi. He also flew out to meet our liaison, you know, our Singapore liaison in Thailand. And the guy and our liaison at the time, who was in Abu Dhabi, is actually a Thai American and speaks Thai. So we actually sent him into Thailand as well to help out. So these two detectives handcuffed this guy, put him on a plane back to JFK Airport, in which myself and a couple of other, the detectives from the homicide case were at the tarmac to grab this guy off the plane. And that happened literally from the first phone call to the time we're on the tarmac was less than 48 hours. It was probably like 36, well, maybe 48 hours from start to finish. So just an unbelievable story of to show the network and how important and really why such a unit is critical for an organization like the NYPD.
Now you're doing cool things like that. Like that's a podcast. That's a movie. That's a short story. That's incredible. Why do you retire? When do you know it's time to hang up the cuffs and you know what? I'm done with this.
Well, I think that, you know, I spent 8 years as the commander of the International Domestic Liaison Unit, 8 years. And I think that, you know, as I said before, I was on six continents. I've done so much and just had such a blessed career. And, you know, I pinch myself every day when I think about what I accomplished and really what the opportunities that the NYPD gave to me and the people who believed in me and gave me those opportunities, you know, I'm forever in debt. But I think for my family, I've spent in such, you know, a large amount of time at work, you know, away from my wife and three children, and, you know, all over the world, globe hopping, which I know you like to do. You know, I figured, you know, I really wanted to be there and help, you know, be more involved with raising my children. As you know, one of the things that I'm as much as I love the NYPD, I'm a passionate father. And I think that really the calling to be a father, and really just be more engaged in my kids' life was why I ultimately made the decision to separate from the NYPD and retire. Yep.
Many police officers have side jobs. 99% of them are security officers or drivers. I think I'm the only crazy one with a podcast. You had a really different one. You were running baseball camps in Dominican Republic. And again, another cool title. So we learned about John Medrick, Lieutenant John Medrick. Now you were the GM of JV3 Baseball in Santo Domingo, DR. What was that about? How did you get involved in that? Because that was, when I heard that, I'm like, psh, what are you talking about? He runs baseball camps. How did that even happen?
Well, you know, I've been traveling back and forth to the Dominican Republic for about 20 years. I speak fluent Spanish. You know, going back to my days in academia, academia, where we talk about, where I was talking about me not being exactly a stellar student. I remember, you know, barely passing high school Spanish by the like literally by inches, and me saying, I'm never going to need to learn this. I wound up, you know, falling in love with Hispanic culture and really learning to speak the language, listening to the music, traveling for 20 years back and forth to the Dominican Republic. When I went to the Dominican Republic, I've been married now for, you know, over 15 years. When I started going back and forth, like quite frequently with my wife and also, you know, on my own, you know, I just fell in love with the culture and the people. And you know, I had the opportunity to go and just check out some local little leagues in Santiago, where my wife's from. I got some properties in Santiago as well. But I would go back and forth and it would just, you know, I would just scratch my head and say, you know, growing up and having the opportunities just to play sports, as we know, Mike, you know, look, we're two huge sports buffs and we love sports. And, you know, although we never necessarily played sports at a professional level, we've talked about this offline, you know, sports have helped shape who we ultimately became. You know, the team building, the overcoming adversity, the mental toughness piece of sports that we were able to take and become, you know, helped us become successful in life. You know, when I was looking at what was going on down there, and I said, wow, you know, just look at the conditions these kids play in. You know, literally when you hear the stories, I know you hear stories about, oh, they were using like a fishing net wrapped up and tied, and, you know, they were using a cardboard mitt as a glove. No, it's true. You know, it's true. You know, they're running around the bases barefoot. It's absolutely true because, you know, I saw it, you know, firsthand for the last two decades. So I got involved early on, just philanthropically, quite frankly, just helping out, you know, funding some little leagues, like, you know, buying 100 kids in a little league in Santiago uniforms, you know, doing, you know, anytime I was in, you know, I would be in Model's Sporting Goods, if that dates me, I guess, a little bit, but I was in Model's Sporting Goods, you know, at the end of baseball season here in the States, and I would see a bunch of baseball mitts 80% off, you know, selling for a cheap price. I would literally pick up dozens of them with my own money and, you know, just go down and hand them out, you know, hand them out down in the DR. You know, I would, myself and my brother, my brother Warren was very involved, as well as, you know, Victor, my good friend Victor Campos has been very involved with me in doing that, you know, fixing up their fields. So it just became a passion just to help kids. And then with that, I kind of just started, you know, learning from some of the best trainers, you know, and instructors, I believe, in the world. I really just, and it's not that much different than policing. You say, what are you talking about? And it's really not. Like when I started learning the ins and outs of becoming a baseball trainer, instructor, it's just, you know, I believe, and again, this is just my opinion on it. You know, I'm not saying that I'm the best in the world. What I would say is I have an extreme, I can pay extreme attention to detail the same way we can and we were taught to do from the police department. And when you have that skill set and the willingness to remain coachable, there's not much you can't learn, right? So I was just given the opportunity again. People believed in me again. People gave me an opportunity to share their knowledge and their experience with me which I looked at this as a great opportunity just to be a sponge and soak up everything when it comes to, you know, developing a player from a physical standpoint, developing a player from a mental standpoint, hitting skills, throwing skills, fielding skills, and then understanding how to put that all together and eventually market players to one of the 30 organizations of Major League Baseball. So I would say it was something I surely wasn't looking for when I started. But again, people just believing in me and willing to pour their expertise and their knowledge into me. And I guess me just being willing to listen.
You moved down to God's country now. You're retired. You have a little few gigs. You have a beautiful family, coaching your son, who's an up-and-coming stud athlete. But instead of staying retired, chilling in a nice backyard, having a beer, relaxing, you take on a project. But this isn't just a little project, a side gig. It's a potentially worldwide sporting changing venture. So let's get to it. Let's talk about this thing. I heard it on Mike Francesa, Dan Patrick, WFAN, CBS Radio with Maggie Gray. How did John Medrick get involved in Baseball United? How did this whole thing come about?
Oh, Mike, again, you know, I think that when you talk about everything in your life, right, that I was experienced in my life, that I was able to accomplish, that people were able to pour into me, I think that was just setting myself and really the rest of this group up to do the impossible and you know, bring baseball to 2 billion people on the other side of the world. You know, when you think about the group that we've put together, really, it's an all-star team. It's a Hall of Fame team, quite frankly, of individuals. And when I say it's a Hall of Fame team, there's no doubt we have two Hall of Famers already on board, and we have a few future Hall of Famers who are going to be announcing pretty soon. But it's not just those Hall of Famers. And I'll tell you, I think the world of those guys. And this is not taking anything away from them. But it's the entire group is a Hall of Famer in their own right. Our CEO, Cash Shake, if you get to know this guy from a business and leadership perspective, Hall of Famer every day of the week. You know, the group of individuals that we've put together to build this dream of Baseball United, it's just mind blowing. You know, when you say you came out of retirement, no. This is like a dream come true for me. This is me living like a childhood dream, quite frankly. And I don't even look, you know, when they say you don't work a day in your life, you know, if you're doing what you love, and this is more than something I love. This is the essence of who we are. I mean, every single person who's involved in Baseball United is just so over the top passionate about this. And, you know, obviously it's a baseball league long by in November 2023, but it's so much bigger than that, right? Baseball United is a platform in which, you know, we are going to take not only the top down approach with the professional league, but actually a bottom up approach, a grassroots approach to, you know, mass participation, boys, girls, you know, of all colors, religions, creeds, ages, participating in the game of baseball, you know, and really learning and exporting American goodwill and American culture through the game of baseball. So it's a dream project, and you know, it's something that I don't think, you know, I got to pinch myself again for you know, when we talked about my past. I mean, I was talking about pinching myself because I can't believe it's a reality. But then I actually got to be honest with you, by the grace of God, and I was given an opportunity by the group that I'm working with to be a part of this. It's such a humbling experience to be where I am here, because I really have to pinch myself again and say, how the hell am I where I am in the position that I'm in with the group, you know, that we're about to make history with. So just really exciting stuff, man.
When we're drunk at a bar, you know, you'll text your boy, hey, bro, let's run the marathon. Let's go to Thailand and, you know, play with the Tigers and stuff. You have this idea, obviously a million parts, a million moving pieces. When did you really know, like, oh, we have something here? Was it when someone signed on? Was it when the team came? When did you know, like, no, this is going to happen?
You know, when you have the individuals that we have on board, right, and everyone brings their own skill set, you know, like I talked about our CEO, Cash Shake, you know, a couple of minutes ago, you know, when you bring a guy like him on board, right, and you see the skill set that he brings, I realized how much I don't know and how much I need to learn, right? When you bring a guy like B-Lark, Barry Larkin, my boy, on board, and you see, obviously, we as baseball fans from the generation that watched B-Lark playing know what he was on the field. But then when you hear him speak eloquently about the game and his vision and about the baseball curriculum that he's created, his experience to bring the game internationally, whether it's to Brazil, was involved in the Million Dollar Arm Project at India. When you hear this, you're like, oh my God, I have so much to learn. So I guess when you think about Mariano, the GOAT, right? And you see the passion and the humility in Mariano and how much he's been involved and really believes in what we're doing. When you see that, like, and I'm just using three of the guys who are really front and center as faces of what we're doing. Cash, my boy Cash, my brother Cash, B-Lark, and Mariano. When you see those guys, I think when I saw them come aboard and I realized how much they knew that I didn't, that's kind of when I know, okay, this is something serious here. It's not just, you know, even though it was a dream, it could still be a dream, but a dream without the plan and the ability to execute, it's simply a dream. I mean, I think that the guys I mentioned, as well as some others in the background, have made this dream more than a dream and surely put together a plan that we're currently executing. So I think that my come to Jesus moment, if you will, when in regards to when I knew, it's when I realized what they knew and how much I did.
I'm going to piggyback on that because I've been on a lot of those phone calls, a lot of those Zooms. And I remember you told me about it initially. You're like, hey, Mike, I had this idea. And you told me, I remember, I'm like, this is a sick idea. But again, you and I, NYPD, that's it. We're like, let's go play baseball in Dubai. And then, you know, you're telling me more. I'm asking a lot more questions. And I'll tell you the moment for me when I knew it was big. It was one of the first calls with Barry Larkin. And I was on the Zoom with you guys, the FaceTime. And Larkin cut everybody off and goes, we know about the professionals. When are we going to do – are we doing something with the Little League guys? I want to build them up because in 15 years – and when he – Barry Larkin, I never even thought about – he's like, listen, we'll get the pros in there tomorrow. That's not a problem. We'll get any pro we want to play tomorrow with you guys. I want the 8-year-old to develop to the 18-year-old stud. We're going to – when he started talking about 15, 20, 25-year development, I'm like, oh, my God, this is way bigger than I thought. And I started seeing the ideas from everybody. I'm like, oh, we had a small piece of it. These guys look so – they made the whole thing complete.
Oh, that's right. You know, yeah. Well said, Mike. I'll tell you. You know, the sustainability in what we're doing is through the kids, right? It's through this young generation. You know, when kids – as you know, that part of the world, you're talking about there's a billion cricket fans, which is another bat and ball sport. They have a skill set that I'm not saying it's exactly the same as baseball, but they have a skill set of swinging and throwing and catching and running, right? The biggest bat and ball sport on earth is cricket. Now, when you talk about baseball, right, and we as Baseball United are successful in putting a bat and ball in these kids' hand and giving them that experience to fall in love with the game like we did, we know that's the sustainability and that's the future, right? We have a mission statement, and the mission statement is not, you know, so overthought. It's not, you know, it's very simple. It's to inspire 2 billion new baseball fans on the other side of the globe. That's our mission statement. And as we do that, and as we're successful in that mission, that's the sustainability piece. So we're so committed to the bottom-up approach. And I'll tell you this. We love obviously the league, but when you want to talk passion with the likes of Cash, Mariano, Barry, myself, Warren, Victor, some, you know, the team that's involved, Eddie Diaz, another one who has a great background in the game of baseball. But when you talk about getting people excited on our team, it's about the, you know, how do we reach out to the kids? How do we reach out to the youth? How do we give people the opportunity, kids to play the opportunity, you know, give kids the opportunity to play the game of baseball, to fall in love with the game of baseball? What I'll say is, you know, one of the things that we do in Baseball United, and Barry's very passionate about this, is, and it's funny because Barry is an ex-player, obviously, who played at the highest level and is a former Hall of Famer. But one of the things that he constantly reminds us of, and every Zoom call that I'm on, quite frankly, it's some way or another it comes out. Baseball's not just about the players. For every player that's on the field, there's 12 people behind him, generally speaking, who's working in order to put that product on the field. So as we go and we inspire these two billion fans on the other side of the globe, maybe they all will not have the opportunity or the capability or the capacity to play professional baseball. But if we do our job and inspire them to love the game and teach them life lessons through the game, then we'll also have opportunities that come along to be, you know, hey, maybe a kid isn't a great, you know, doesn't have enough ability to play at the professional level, but they're a great communicator and they could be a broadcaster in a league. Or somebody who, you know, a young girl who loves the game and loves to be on the field, but maybe isn't going to have the opportunity to play professionally. She happens to be good at math. Maybe they could be a statistician in a league. So we've committed to this overall building of a baseball infrastructure of not just about the games and putting players on the field. Like I said, it takes a tremendous amount of resources and really, you know, everything that goes on behind the scenes makes the game possible. So not only are we investing in the game and the league, but we're investing in the individuals who are going to make that league and really what we're doing possible.
How'd you get involved with Mariano Rivera and Barry Larkin? Because those are the two, when everyone's like, they hear about Baseball United, everyone's like, oh, that's a great idea. Then you're like, oh yeah, we have Mariano Rivera and Barry Larkin. Whoa, now this is, it gave you such credibility, so much street cred. How'd you get involved with those two?
Well, you know, well, obviously those, in my opinion, those guys are two legends, and those guys are two guys whose names are so, you know, synonymous with greatness on the field, but just as important off the field. Hence, that's why, you know, we wanted to go approach both of those individuals and let them know what we're doing. And I'll tell you this. Both of those guys have been on since the earliest stages, and those guys aren't like figureheads that we use, you know, their face or their picture or video. No, these guys are involved. I mean, Mike, look, you said you were on numerous Zoom calls, and it's true. I mean, obviously the listeners are kind of like, yeah, they're probably just, you know, you're using their like image.
Oh, no.
These guys are in the trenches. I mean, you got to meet Mariano on multiple occasions doing some press stuff, and as well as Barry. And, you know, these guys are just class acts. And the thing is, we knew that we wanted people who were going to be in the trenches with us, who had experience internationally, as they both have, with the game of baseball, and were passionate with integrity. And really, you know, our CEO, Cash, always talks about, you know, building the right way with the right people. And we've had many ball players that we've spoke to, and we'll be making announcements in the near future about some of the new additions. But really, from a governance and stewardship perspective, we couldn't be more blessed to have the two Hall of Famers that we have, Mariano and Barry, with us from day one in the trenches, with their passion to make this a reality. So hats off to them, because you asked how I guess we got them. Really, it was just a matter of, you know, I'll steal a line from my boy Cash here. He talks about oftentimes the angel in the marble, right? So normal people like myself see a slab of marble. Michelangelo saw an angel. He carved away until that angel was there. When we presented what we were doing, I got to be honest with you, by the grace of God, I think Mariano and Barry saw the angel in the marble. And it wasn't just about, you know, a business that was going to be thriving. No, no. This was about doing good, building right with the right people in order to give people an opportunity to fall in love with the game that's done so much for all of us. So I think, as Cash says, they had the ability to see the angel in the marble.
You're a huge sports fan, as am I. And one of my favorite games is when you send me a picture of who you're FaceTiming with or Zooming at that time. As a fan, I'm like, how are we not signing blank right now? But yet you afterwards, you're like, no, Mike, you know, integrity-wise, there's so many other factors besides a name thing. Did you realize that when you start having these big names on, And then, not that you're going to turn them away, but maybe they might not be involved right away. Was that weird for you being a sports fan, being like, oh my God, I'm interviewing Hall of Famer blank, but he's not a good fit for the league?
Yeah, I guess in some regards it does, because as a sports fan, you know, and a guy who grew up in the generation we grew up in watching these guys on TV, yeah, there's obviously that moment of, wow, I can't believe I have the opportunity to speak to so-and-so and you know, interview them for a potential position. But I would say this, you know, going back to my time with the NYPD, you know, because of the position that I was in, I had the awesome opportunity, you know, to stand shoulder to shoulder with the President of the United States, with the Prime Minister of Australia, with the King of Jordan, and the likes of those people. So I think that gave me a little bit of an experience, different than most would have taking such a position. And then also being involved in the Dominican Republic with my baseball academy that we talked about earlier. You know, I was exposed and have been around pro ball players for a very long time. So one of the things that you realize is that human beings are human beings and human beings, right? And we all put our pants on the same way. And when you think of it from that perspective, and you think about what we're trying to do in Baseball United, again, inspire 2 billion new people to fall in love with the game of baseball, you know, it's as important right at the top of our level of importance is who we bring aboard. So, you know, this is so much bigger than any one of us. It's so much bigger than me. So I think that when you think of it from that perspective, it doesn't make it as challenging as it would be if you didn't.
Right now, the next big event is the Baseball United Showcase, November 2023. Tell me about that. I know nothing's set in stone yet. What does it entail? Because on the website, baseballunited.com, it looks sick. We're going to have a showcase November 2023. Tell me about it.
Yeah, no, we're excited, Mike. So November 2023, it's going to be the first time ever, history in the making, my friend. It's going to be, the first presentation of professional baseball ever on the Arabian Peninsula. We're going to be playing at Dubai International Stadium, which is a 25,000-seat stadium. It would be like, I guess for the baseball listeners and the sports fans on, listeners, it would be like the Yankee Stadium of the cricket world in Dubai, right? And, you know, we're going to be converting that to a baseball field for our games. We're going to be bringing over four franchises. Again, these are new franchises. We'll be announcing the names of them in the near future with professional players. We have an extremely diverse roster with a very, very, very high level of baseball being played. I mean, you know, I could tell you this. We have over 30 countries represented on our rosters. And when you look at from a quality of play perspective, we're in the top five leagues in the world. You obviously got Major League Baseball, the Nippon League, the Korean Baseball League. And we believe we're right there at number four, Baseball United. The quality of play, we have, you know, we've went out, we found the best player, the best pitcher, you know, from Finland, throwing a ball 90 plus miles an hour. But then we'll also have, you know, who's played professionally in Australia. He's played professionally in Europe as well. But then we'll have a guy who's a 10-year major league vet, you know, who's, you know, spent 10 years in the big leagues on those rosters. So, you know, we're excited about it. This is going to be our first 1 million fans, right? And what I mean by 1 million, I'm talking about those who tune in, those who show up at the stadium. So we're really excited about it. It's going to be really earth-shattering, and really it's going to be where we prove to the rest of the world, here we are, Baseball United's here to stay, and we're excited.
You're the executive vice president of baseball operations. That means what?
Well, that means I'm in charge of all, you know, things baseball related. That could be anything from, you know, developing the rosters. So it's player acquisition, right? It's negotiating the terms of the contracts that the players sign. It's, interviewing our managers and coaches, and some of the managers and coaches that we already have locked in are very notable guys out of the major leagues. And, you know, when we announce those in the coming weeks and months, I'm sure many of your listeners will know who these people are. Mm-hmm. It's about interviewing them and eventually deciding, who's going to be getting a job and where they're going to be. It's, you know, equipment procurement, Like, so, you know, there's not necessarily baseballs in Dubai right at the moment. There's not necessarily bats. How do we now build the field out like we're talking about? It's, you know, getting the training staff there. What if there's an injury? You know, game match umpires, statisticians. It's basically every single responsibility necessary to put the product of baseball on the field, you know, procurement of uniforms as well. Like, so all those things are really under my responsibility.
Initially, how many teams are we going to have?
So our short-term plan is we're going to have most likely four teams come to the showcase. You know, then right after our showcase in November of 2023, where we'll have four franchises playing, just after that in early 2024, so January, February time, and again, we're bookending the Major League Baseball season, we're playing at the time when winter leagues play, like the Mexican Winter League and the Dominican Winter League, the Venezuelan Winter League. So January, February 2024, we're going to be playing a 40-game season with six franchises. And then at the end of the 2024, like November time, we'll be playing a 60-game season with eight franchises playing.
Will you be having tryouts? Like, you got major leaguers, you got former minor leaguers, you got international guys. You have guys just on the cusp that can try out or not yet?
Yeah. We will do that. You know, our job is to give people an opportunity, or give, you know, players an opportunity who maybe have gotten overlooked. You know, we obviously have a large pool of players that we can select from a player acquisition perspective, Mike. We already have enough players to play if we were playing yesterday. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to find the best players, the players who are going to represent Baseball United in the, you know, in the best possible way. Also, we want to find those kids, those needles in the haystack, who are going to give, you know, and give those kids an opportunity, right? So we'll be announcing pretty soon some of the open tryouts we'll be doing and things like that. So we look forward to that, and we look forward to any listener, quite frankly, who thinks they got what it takes to play pro ball, to come out and give it a shot to lace them up out in Dubai.
Merchandise is so important. When can fans expect to see any kind of merch, maybe a logo, a hat, t-shirt? People love that stuff. When can we expect that?
Oh, my man, I can tell you, and I know you're a merch lover. You're going to go crazy when you see the merch that we have. The brands, the logos, I mean, simply unbelievable. You know, I'll tell you, we were at I won't say the city and I won't say the name of the team, because that's all, you know, something strategic that I want to be releasing. But we were in a city, you know, in the Gulf area in the Middle East, and we were presenting to a group of young, energetic sports fans. And, you know, they asked us, can we see the logo? Can we see the team name? We put it up on the screen, which was basically the logo of the team from the city that they represented. Okay. And they were like, oh my God, that's awesome. Where do I get that? I need that right now. What we're doing is we feel really good about the brand of Baseball United. It's a young brand. It connects with this new generation, right? It's not something that's antiquated and old. All of our brands are representative of a new generation trying to reach out to that younger generation. You know, there's a statistic, actually, one that's quite alarming, that says that individuals, kids 18 years or younger in the United States, kids 18 years or younger in the United States, only 7% of those kids only 7% baseball is the – only 7% of those kids believes baseball is their favorite sport. So what we understand here in Baseball United is it's so important for us to reach out to this young generation and really create, and to your point about merch is so important, creating brands that we feel good about and that we know will appeal to this new demographic and new generation. So you'll see in the coming weeks and months, we'll be strategically releasing the names of the teams, the logos, merch will start going online. So we're really excited about that. And we know that there's going to be a huge market for this, because just what we're doing, and when you see it, the feel of it, it's real cool, it's real hip, and it's really going to engage this generation.
It's a cricket mad world out there. The most watched thing in the world is India, Pakistan playing cricket. Cricket is king out there. You guys are going to shimmy your way in. You know, the little baby brother's coming in. Do you think there's going to be a crossover with cricket players, maybe checking it out, maybe getting involved somehow? Because that would be huge for you guys, see if they want to test their skills on the baseball diamond.
Yeah, absolutely. We're surely open to it. I mean, early on, Mike, when we took on this project, we believed that our first strategy was going to be able to start influencing cricket fans to become fans of the game of baseball. Since you know, that's still one of our strategies, but quite frankly, it's not necessarily the one we're trying tomorrow, because what has became such a breath of fresh air, and we're so excited about the amount of fans on the ground today in the Middle East and in India, Pakistan, South Asia is overwhelming. Tens of millions of people are currently avid fans of the game of baseball. And, you know, from a product market fit, we're in a very good place. However, one of our really, to go to the next level, we're really excited to start creating engagement between the cricket and baseball world. We have some really cool, things that we're doing in the horizon in the near future in order to gauge some of that audience and really try to inspire some of those cricket bowlers to see if they can get on the mound and see if they can, bring it from the mound. We'll see. But we're really excited to give those kids an opportunity, because we definitely think there is a skill set that will fit, fit into what we're doing for sure.
On paper, you tell anyone, sounds like fun. You're hanging out with former major leaguers, Hall of Fame guys. You're traveling the world, starting a baseball league, hanging out in Dubai. Obviously, there's hurdles. And what are the biggest hurdles you're facing with the league?
Well, I think that, anytime you're doing something that's new, people, there's some doubt in people's minds, right? And anytime that you're a trailblazer, people question why you're doing it, right? And when you think about baseball has been so, embedded in American culture and history for well over 100 years, Latin American culture as well. And when you look at the game of baseball, how it, hasn't necessarily made its way to this part of the world, we are often asked, well, do you think that, the fans will engage or will accept the game of baseball? And there's no doubt about it. As I told you, a lot of what we've done and a lot of the early work we've done recently is to really go through that market and understand what is the size of the baseball, the avid baseball fans there today. And like I told you, it's tens of millions of people. So there's no doubt that that's the case. But oftentimes, I guess when you're doing something from the beginning and when you're starting something from scratch, anytime you're starting anything from scratch, it's difficult. I mean, imagine me saying to you, hey, Mike, you're from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, started, and you told me, you said, I want to start, a youth little league. That's enough of a challenge in and of itself. Now talk about a professional baseball league with the infrastructure of youth development, at the core of what we're doing on the other side of the globe. Obviously, it comes with its challenges. However, what I would say is, this team that we've assembled has more than met the task. And every single day we're overcoming challenges. And to be quite frank, what we've been able to accomplish in the time that we have, there's no doubt it would take others a decade to do. Really inspiring stuff and just exciting. But, obviously it's difficult what we're pulling off here.
Ready to finish up with some quick hit questions.
Sure.
You and I at a bar in New York City, who's the coolest person in your phone that if you texted them, they would text you back? You want to impress everyone here in the bar. Who are you going to text?
Well, I got to go with Mariano Barry.
Awesome answer. It's funny. I love when I ask people that and they give me the answer. Mariano Rivera, especially in New York, that might top almost all of them. That's a great answer.
Yeah.
How about one sporting event in history John Medrick wishes he witnessed live?
Ooh. Well, one sporting I'll change the question. The one that I'm sitting in Dubai in November of 2023, Baseball United's inaugural game and inaugural showcase is going to be the event that I'm at. And that, the day after, you can ask me the same question and that would be it.
That's what, the next day after some beers, I'm going to actually, we'll do another podcast. Deal?
Absolutely, brother.
How about this? I know you're not a memorabilia guy. You're not a swag guy. Coolest piece of memorabilia that you own. It doesn't have to be sports related. The coolest piece of memorabilia John Meijer owns is what?
Okay. I wouldn't call it a piece of memorabilia, but it's something that's quite important to me. I still have my badge and my ID card that was issued to me when I was working with the Jordanian police intelligence, which I think there's probably like myself and maybe the individual who's there now, maybe two, there's probably like two or three of these that exist in the world in which an American cop, I have an ID card from the public security directorate of Jordan in written in Arabic, you know, that gives me police power, that identified me as a police employee in the country when I was there and with the shield. So I think that's like one of my most prized possessions there.
Last show you binged watched?
Oof. Last show I binge watched. You know, I flew to Dubai. I was in Dubai not long ago, obviously with Baseball United. And I was on the flight back, which, as you know, was quite long. And they had a couple of episodes of Ted Lasso. Okay. And I was quite late to the show. I was quite late to the Ted Lasso show. Because I'll say, Mike, I'm not a huge TV guy, right? Mm-hmm. I watch a lot of sports and things like that. I don't really watch shows. So I just was trying to pass the time on the TV. And they had like the first 8 episodes or something on the flight. And I watched it. And I literally got off the flight, and as I'm in the Uber on the way home, I'm downloading whatever it is. It's like on Prime TV or whatever it was, or Apple TV, to get now the next few seasons. So I would say Lasso.
It's 2:15 in the morning. You come home. What's your binge meal? 2:15 in the morning. Wife and kids are away. You're home alone. You can eat whatever you want in your boxer shorts watching an old baseball game. What are you eating?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, probably anything because I'm a bit old these days. But, I can't go with a burger and fries because I'm sure that's what, like, most guys say. Uh-huh. What am I eating? Okay, you know what? I and this is no joke. I would eat some good Arabic food, Lebanese food, right? You know, shish tawouk, a little, you know, chicken shish kebab, lamb, hummus, falafel, good Arabic food, Lebanese.
I'm going to give the plug for you because I know you're not a big social media guy. Go to baseballunited.com, sign up for the newsletter. You'll be notified of all the big news, the big signings, the teams' names dropping, everything in between. You guys are on Instagram at baseballunited. On Facebook at baseballutd. You're on Twitter. You're everywhere. John Meijer, this was an absolute blast. I hope you had a great time. This was super fun, and we've been wanting to do this for a while. Wish we were doing it live over some beers, but that will happen down the road. This is great. Baseball United, I'm excited about. And one thing on the other side of the mic, I've had you on. I've had Mariano a couple times, Barry, and they talk about their career. They'll talk about the Yankees and the Reds, World Series, Hall of Fames. The minute they talk about Baseball United, they kind of like, you know, perker up a little bit. They start smiling and they talk about it. Barry Larkin talked about, like you said, the girl who wants to play or the kid who's very poor but wants to play. He talks so passionate about the kids. Rivera obviously tells a story about him in Panama. All they care about the kids growing to love the game. And I'm like, oh my God. I left there forgetting about professional baseball players over there. I'm like, oh my God, in 15 years in the Middle East, in Dubai, in these other places where the game, there's going to be huge fans of baseball that weren't there 10 years ago. It's kind of mind-boggling, man.
No, absolutely, Mike. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about myself, but more importantly, to talk about Baseball United and about what we're going to do. Yeah, look, Mike, Baseball United is something that we're so passionate about. What I would end on is if you look at the world and you look at how fractured the world is today, the world that we live in, you know, the billions and billions and billions of dollars that are spent on diplomacy. You know, we believe in Baseball United that we're more similar than we are different as humans. And we believe in really our core, at the core of what we're doing is the word unity, right? To unite people. And we believe that sports has that unique ability to unite people. And we truly believe the game of baseball can and will do just that. We actually you know, coined the phrase baseball diplomacy, because that's what we're about. We're about bringing the game and all the goodwill that comes with it to the rest of the world, and trying to inspire unity through the game and opportunity through the game. So just an awesome, awesome opportunity that we're all humbled by. Obviously, I know you had to just throw out to the fans that, you know, you have me on talking about Baseball United, but you also have Barry and Mariano, so you're kind of overshadowing me a little bit, but that's okay. So you're 100% right that we're all just so passionate about this. And when you see from our CEO to our Hall of Famers to the rest of us involved in Baseball United, it's just an awesome opportunity to do good with good people and to really try to, you know, be a positive change in the world today through the game of baseball. So
thank you again. And again, this has been a blast on my end, because I've been here since the beginning when you told me, hey, Mike, I'm starting this little thing. And then to watch it on the outside and watching it go to these lengths, listen to you guys on Mike Francesa, senior on Dan Patrick, it's like, are you kidding me? So congratulations. And I'm excited. Right now we're in the dirt level, and yet it's still huge. It's going to be mountains and mountains, and I'm loving watching this, man. Thank you again for giving me a front row seat to this.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate all the help and all the hard work from you, and really appreciate your friendship. And Baseball United appreciates all the support you give us. Thank you, sir.
I'll talk to you soon, my friend. Thank you.
All right, my brother.
Bye-bye.